That teenagers and adults have a hard time understanding one another is not surprising or new. All you have to do is read Romeo and Juliet, or go to any young adult section in any bookstore or library, and you will find the story of grown-ups who just don't understand, told and retold in seemingly infinite variations. But there are times when failing to understand what a teen is experiencing can have dire consequences. In the aftermath of a serious loss, it's important to know how to pay attention and ask questions. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we'll get a better understanding of how teens process and express grief. Coming up after this news.
When I was in high school, my junior year, we lost three people. We lost six people in the time I was in high school, in 4 years, in a big suburban high school. But at the same time, I don't know if we hit the law of averages or what, but I don't think they've ever had a year like that, other than the year that I was there.
Ellie Moxley is a reporter here at KCUR. When we started talking in our newsroom about recent suicides at a high school in Olathe, Ellie remembered what it was like to be part of a group of teenagers experiencing loss together.
When you have something like that happen, when you lose that many people as a teenager, I think it changes how you grieve from then on. Most of the deaths were my junior year of high school. And my senior year, my grandfather passed away. And I felt terrible for my father and my mother and my grandmother. But I didn't grieve in the same way for him as I did for my friends, for my classmates. And you feel bad about it at the time because this is a family member. This is someone who's been in your life since you were born, that you love dearly and that you miss horribly. I think the reason that kids remember the people in their graduating class who don't get to graduate, who don't make it that far, is because there's just this whole feeling of lost potential. Whether it's a suicide or an accident or an illness, some other circumstance, you know, you're not only grieving for the person, you're grieving for what could have been. And I think that's really what I wanted to get at when I suggested you guys do a show about teens and grief, because I think it is more than just, you know, trying to remember someone and, you know, honor their legacy. It's also trying to be respectful of the fact that you get to go on and they don't.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're taking Ellie's advice and exploring how teens deal with grief. How do people at this tender stage of development express feelings of profound loss? And how can the adults around them, who might also be grieving, help them through it? With us this morning are two guests. First, I'd like to introduce Heather Fitzcharles Keller. She's a psychotherapist and instructor at community colleges throughout the Kansas City area. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
When you hear Ellie saying that these early experiences with grief inform how you cope with loss from then on, does that ring true for you? Is that what's at stake here?
I do think so. It is what's at stake because it kind of changes the perception that teens have about their life, their mortality. It makes it more real for them, the idea of mortality.
What's different about how teens experience grief when compared with either little kids or grown-ups?
What's different is that teens are in a very unique stage of development in their brain. They are in a stage where parts of the brain of the frontal lobe have developed that allow them to be impulsive, that allow them to make decisions without thinking it through, because the rest of our brain isn't developed until we're about 25 years of age.
The part that does think things
through. The part that does the dichotomous thinking and lets us.
What is dichotomous thinking?
Dichotomous thinking is where we weigh out the good and the bad, where we can look at a situation and say, it's not all good or it's not all bad. And so teens can't do that yet. But they can be impulsive, and they are thinking in the present. And at that time, their identity is forming. They have a sense of self that is very different. They're more concerned about themselves and their friends than they are about anything else because they're trying to figure out who they are. And they also tend to be, they tend to look at themselves as if they're different. It's what we call in the field the person fable. They tend to see themselves as unique, even to their peers. They look at their perceptions and they look at what's happening in their life. So their pain is different from other pain. And things that happen in the immediate, you know, what happens immediately is more important than what's going to happen in the future.
It seems like it would be so hard for someone to approach a person who believes that they are the only one who has ever experienced what they're experiencing right now, to be able to really connect with that person and help them through it, to say either I've been through something like what you're going through, or maybe even I'm going through this also right now too. How do you connect with someone who believes that his or her pain is unique?
You just have to try to draw them out. You try to ask them how they feel. You let it be from their perception. The mistake that I think that a lot of adults make with teenagers when they're grieving is that they wait for the teen to come to them. And you have to go to the teen and ask how they're doing.
Why do people wait for the teen to come to them?
Because we have that sense that they'll let us know if they need something, because that's how they operate on a certain level. They tend to want adults to leave them alone. And so it's finding a balance between leaving them alone and talking to them.
How do the social dynamics of a high school either help or complicate matters when it comes to grieving?
It does both, in a way, because peers are the most important things to adolescents. They tend to, everything is focused on their peer group, but at the same time, they don't want to stand out to their peer group. They value everything that they say. They question everything that adults say and all the values that they've learned. So being part of a peer group is important because it provides support. But then there's that person fable. I'm different. Even though I am part of this group, I'm different from this group.
What do like cliques have to do with it? Because that's such a big part of what I remember as the high school experience, is that there's this constant fluctuation of who's in and who's out. Right. And depending on where you are in that process, when something really tragic happens, it could be a very different experience.
Well, yes. Teens are part of cliques and crowds. So you have crowds, groups of teens that do the same thing. And within those crowds, you have cliques, closer friends. And that does change from time to time. And it does change depending on what's happening and where they are in their identity. And so if someone goes through something traumatic, they tend to come together more. Those cliques tend to come together more because it's that identifying this person went through that. It's as if the other teens want to be a part of it.
Can it be a source of reconciliation as well?
It can. It definitely can.
Your expertise has to do with suicide in particular, which unfortunately is incredibly relevant to a lot of our community right now. There are so many difficult issues that come up with suicide, but how do teens deal with the suicide of a classmate or peer?
It brings to light for them their own mortality, which is something they tend not to think about. So losing a peer makes it very real that death is real. As in the beginning of the show, they were talking about losing a grandparent versus losing a friend. It's very different. The grandparent is perceived as being old and they can, you know, it's their time has come. But peers, they're sort of immortal. You know, a teen doesn't see that their peers will ever be gone. And so it brings to light their own mortality. And during that really delicate stage of identity development where you're searching for yourself, suddenly losing something like a peer, that makes you feel like it could be me next.
Well, but and with suicide, though, it seems like there are all sorts of other existential questions that come up about either meaning or identity or just a kind of pain that can exist in a person's life.
Well, suicide, the grief that's left behind from suicide is one of the most difficult types of grief to reconcile because there's never any answers. You never reach an understanding of why someone would do that. The difference in teens, though, is that sometimes it can trigger in them their own pain, their own feelings of not being able to go on. And so it can go a couple of different ways. It can either strengthen their connection to other friends and to try to find answers and comfort together, or for certain teens who may be going through their own type of pain or their own kind of struggles, it may make them feel as if that's something they want to consider. It's really important at that point for the adults in their life to really draw them out, talk with them, find out how they're feeling, because it can trigger suicides among peers.
And it sounds like making sure they're not isolated.
Yes, definitely making sure they're not isolated.
Suicide is something that I'd say very few of us at any age really understand or know how to cope with. Do adults inadvertently pass along their own confusion and misunderstandings to the teens in their lives?
They do. They do in all kinds of grief. I've worked with families, too, who have dealt with homicides. And often what I find is that adults, when they're grieving, tend not to notice that the children are grieving. Someone asked me recently if children grieve, and they do. At any age, they grieve. And I think adults take for granted that they're more resilient, that they bounce back easily.
You can call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about teens and grieving. Now let's turn to our other guest, Tichelle Bordere. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Tichelle is an associate professor of child and family development at the University of Central Missouri, and she conducts a lot of research. Tichelle, tell us about your research.
Yeah, sure. I would like to, if it's okay, follow up on some of the questions that you asked a few minutes ago.
Yeah, please.
Okay. I want to mention something that's unique about friendship loss. And Heather, you're right on with your points. I appreciate having you here as well. One thing to note about friendship loss that's different in adolescence is that friends are a huge source of support as teenagers are individuating from parents. And so the loss of a peer, because they're spending larger amounts of time often with peers than at home, the loss of a peer is really akin to the loss of a family member, kind of as losing a fictive kin, you know, losing a member of the family as fictive kin. And so grieving those losses related to friendships due to suicide, homicide, accidental deaths, which would be the number one cause of death in this age range, may be particularly challenging for youth. And in our society, in our thanatophobic or death-denying society, these youth are also less likely to get support for friendship loss compared to other types of loss.
Why would our fear of death just in general play out in that way, that the loss of a friend is something that might go especially under the radar?
It would be especially less noticed, one, because of stereotypes and misconceptions that youth are not grieving, as Heather highlighted. And then, two, in our society, some deaths garner more support than others. So a death due to cancer, for example, a type of death that has a normative cause is more likely to be named because, you know, we all get a birth certificate and a death certificate. Yet we're not socialized. Grief education is not a part of our developmental process. So we have adults who in general are afraid to talk to their children and teens or are hesitant, basically because they just don't have the skills, even though they're well-meaning. And so in times of friendship loss, for example, really it gets less support than a loss than other types of losses. For example, that child might get more support for the death of the grandfather than support, because it's a family, clear-cut family relationship, than they would for the death of a peer.
Why is it that that adults don't notice that teens are grieving?
Because, you know, ironically, a lot of their reactions are related to typical adolescent behavior. You know, adolescents are experiencing numerous changes, hormonal changes, and other, they're coping with so many challenges already, things they're trying to balance. Have you seen the line at Starbucks of adolescents recently, by the way? So our youth, they're already trying to balance so much with not as much support and not wanting as much help from adults who actually might be good sources of support for them. So we're likely to see moodiness from them or some non-compliance as they're individuating from parents. And so some of these same behaviors are also, associated with grief, noncompliance, being angry at everyone and everything because they really haven't had the support to even name. And I have to say this, one very important aspect of supporting our youth and adults alike is helping people name their experience. If you can't name that you're experiencing grief, then you're going to have even greater struggles when you don't understand why you're not sleeping, why you're overeating or undereating, why you're feeling so cranky, why you are bursting into tears because you smell the perfume of your deceased mother or friend. So helping them just even name their experience allows them to understand their behaviors. And it really helps with coping with various types of loss.
I guess I hear you in some way saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that a teenager who is grieving might act in ways that it's easy to dismiss as, well, that's that age group, that's how they act.
But yes, lesson behavior.
And that they might not recognize even in themselves that what they're experiencing is grief. So it takes an adult who's recognizing that to say to them, do you think that this might be related to how you're feeling about X, Y, or Z?
Absolutely. Adolescents, I found in my research and I found across the literature, just again, echoing Heather's point, is that adolescents are much more likely to talk about their experiences literally if you ask them. They've literally said, if they ask me, I'll talk about it. But they're less likely to reach out just because they're trying to be their own independent selves. So, yes.
You know, this summer, KCUR's Peggy Lowe went to a grief counseling program for Kansas City teens who are affected by homicide in their communities. And she met a 14-year-old there who said, quote, I'm here. I'm hurting, too. I'm not just going to wake up and get over it. I don't want you in my face telling me you understand. What do you hear in that, Tichelle?
What I hear is our society, again, because we're thanatophobic and death denying, the idea is that we need to move on. You know, you get 3 days off and then you need to move on with life. But it's important to know what this teen is saying so poignantly is that grief is a lifelong journey. It's going to take her some time to process these feelings, recognize and acknowledge my loss experience, acknowledge that I am a bereaved person as a teenager. And I'm not going to just get over it. I'm familiar with that program and that article. Yes, I commend that teen. That's echoed across my work.
And I want to hear about your work a little bit more shortly. But Heather, what do you hear in that?
Well, that's my panel that I work with on the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. And what I heard in that, there was so much more to that that was reflected. What that teen expressed, for example, is that after she lost her brother to homicide, when she went back to school, after a short period of time, there was this expectation that she was going to be fine, that she should be normal. And the teachers were no longer asking if she was okay. They were acting, this was her words, as if she was okay. And that made her really angry. And so to kind of echo what Tichelle said, she had some acting out that went on because she was angry. But the anger was her way of expressing the grief and the sadness that she felt.
Heather, Tichelle, stay with me through a short station break. Central Standard will be right back. Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. That number again is 816-235-2888. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking about how teens cope with loss and grief. If you experienced loss as a teen, did it affect you in ways that nobody around you quite realized or understood? Tell us about it. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Our guests are also happy to answer whatever questions you may have. Heather Fitzcharles Keller is a psychotherapist and adjunct instructor at community colleges in our area. Hi again, Heather.
Hi.
And Tichelle Bordere is with us from the University of Central Missouri. Welcome back, Tichelle.
Yeah, that's University of Missouri. Thank you, though.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
So, let's talk a little bit about how experiences of sudden loss of peers or relatives or community members affect a teenager's sense of his or her own place in the world, because I feel like that understanding really is not yet fully developed. Heather, do you want to take this?
Can you tell me the question again?
How a sudden loss affects, or maybe a number of sudden losses around a person, depending, affects that teen's own sense of his or her own place in the world, his or her own safety, for example.
Well, as Tichelle said, and we've talked about, peers are really the most important thing in an adolescent's life because they are pulling away from family values and their parents. And so a sudden loss really changes the landscape of their world in a way that they can't predict. They are living in the moment. Everything that's happening is in the moment. Losing someone that's that close is, it really shakes up their reality and forces them to think about things that they're really not prepared to think about, the future, where they, what their place in the world is, what life is going to be like without that person in their world. And so the suddenness can really impact them and can really shake them up.
Tichelle, you specialize particularly in instances of homicide. How does that play out specifically with that?
Yes. With sudden deaths such as homicide or suicide, both very highly stigmatized deaths and less talked about, yet lead to more complicated grief reactions in our children, youth, and adults alike. Really, these experiences shake the, you know, it's called shattered assumptions. It shakes children's and teens' assumptions about the world. During a hallmark of adolescence is fairness and justice is very important to them. And so when a sudden death happens, like a homicide or even a suicide, it shakes their assumptions about the world as a place that's fair, that can be trusted. So youth they often are left without details about what occurred. So less information about the experience that has occurred. And it leaves them in the long term, just like we heard from this teen, it leaves them in the long term being faced with crafting their own story about what happened. So oftentimes these youth have concerns about their continued sense of safety. So they have to do what I describe as survive the death, as well as now survive life in the absence of a person who may have actually been the person who kept that child safe, who told them to go inside when it was dark, when it was getting dark. Who gave them money to cut their grass, or, you know, these people who have died were actually likely played a vital role in their lives. And something else that I want to highlight that I also have found is very important is when you don't have, you know, again, as a cancer is not a less difficult death. I mean, death is hard, period. But when you have a death that has less explanation and you're stuck with only information that is given to you in the media, which is sensationalizes events. You see things happening in the courts. So when a suicide happens, the grief may take longer because you go to the funeral, but now you also have to wait for the trial. Victims and perpetrators usually know each other, so that person remains, you know, continues to walk the streets. Youth who experience homicide and suicide tend to have continued reenactment fantasies, where they have reoccurring thoughts about what, since they don't have a true story, except for police records or media accounts, they're left to create their own images of what they think happened at the time of the death. Their own images of, which are probably more graphic than what has happened. Their own images of the violence.
I want to jump in here because this idea that these people who are teenagers, they're not small children, but that they're still not old enough, or that the people around them aren't comfortable enough to have given them full detailed information. And is how teenagers find out that something has happened, is that important in terms of their process of grieving or how traumatic this will turn out to be in their lives?
It really is. And but here's the other deal. Sometimes, oftentimes in suicides and homicides, we really don't have answers in a lot of cases. And so that, again, complicates the grief process because youth often rely on rumors in the neighborhood or have to rely on police reports or, you know, delivery of information, learning about a death on when they turn on the news. So it tends to be very different, again, from what they might experience with a more normative type of death, like, you know, somebody delivering the news of a family member who died due to a health related cause.
And so that they would have been prepared for that to some extent by
perhaps.
The process.
Yes, perhaps. But again, the details get skewed because you have facts. When my grandfather died of cancer, I had clear facts. I knew his, you know, with a homicide or a suicide, we're left to craft the story, because otherwise it's these deaths get criminalized. So there's extra stigma and you're left with feeling exposed, and the death is public and it's, you can't control how this information is shared, and it's often based around inaccurate information.
Let's talk to one of our callers. Jim in Clinton, Missouri, called 816-235-2888. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Well, mostly I just want to commend your guests for the work that they're doing. I'm getting all choked up just thinking about it. You know, it was 1974 when my oldest brother died, when I was 13 years old, and that was, I think that was the same year that the book on death and dying came out, and my experience was that everybody around me was clueless about grief and how to help any of us with that, my parents, or, you know, as much help as they needed, and they were unable to help any of us. And his death was actually, it was, you know, he died from anaerobic masturbation, and so they actually lied then to us about how he died, and I'd figure that out until I was, you know, like 50 years old, that was actually how he died. And so I spent decades answering questions about whether he committed suicide, you know, and wondering about that. And that, as I continued to work on all of those issues, the issue of suicide became less important. It just, if he committed suicide, it was because he was in pain, you know, and it wasn't because he was bad or evil or anything like that. But just commending your guests for their work, because it's vitally important, and it doesn't end. You know, like I said, 40 years later, I still am dealing with a lot of those issues, and dealing with my other siblings and those kinds of things. So thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Does this idea of creating your own stories in the absence of information, does that ring true for you?
No, I don't remember that being an issue. I guess maybe as I answered questions about whether he actually committed suicide, because I, you know, the first words that I heard was that he hung himself. But then later my dad told me, well, it was just an accident, that somehow the cord from his robe got around his neck. And so I guess I created scenarios and that somehow he was in, you know, incredible amounts of pain that nobody knew about, because we were, you know, we were an uncommunicative family to begin with. I mean, we didn't talk about sex. You know, that was not something my parents were able to talk with us about either. And so the fact that his death had something to do with sex even made it even more complicated for them.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Jim.
Sure.
And I wonder if Jim's story, I mean, it does, his point about communication in general, what kind of relationships foster the kind of stage setting for an honest, open conversation about death? I mean, not every relationship has developed the capacity for that kind of vulnerability.
I think it's really important that parents talk to their kids, speak with them honestly and openly about things such as death and sex, as Jim mentioned. You know, hearing him talk, I couldn't help but think that he went through the last 40 years thinking his brother was in an incredible amount of pain, when that really was not what happened. And he was grieving that pain that his brother might have felt. And I can imagine that he may have felt that, you know, no one, he couldn't reach him. Someone should have been able to reach him if he was in that much pain. I think Jim could have been spared that kind of grief had they talked openly and honestly about what happened. But it's very hard, and it's our own issues as parents that get in the way of us speaking honestly with our kids. And I just want to add one thing, kind of speaking to what we were talking about before. in this day and age, our teens are, everything is complicated by social media. So we have social media. So in cases of homicide and suicide, as well as everything else, everyone is posting things. And the stories, the truth gets stretched in a way that is different than what I might have experienced as a youth. I lost my best friend when I was in eighth grade, and it was very painful. I remember that. But there was no one online talking about what happened to her or the types of things. And some of the kids that I've worked with have talked about how that complicates their grief.
How does it complicate it? Is it just that they aren't able to process their own story around it without someone else's story kind of intervening?
That's part of it. And the details become blurred and they become muddied by other people's fantasies and other people's stories. In the cases of homicides, for example, I've had teens that I work with who they had Facebook pages, for example, for their loved one. And then people who don't even know their loved one go on that page and post something about that person that may or may not be true. So it becomes very, very complicated. And the same rings true for suicide cases.
Let's hear from Steve in Kansas City, Kansas.
Hi. My son was 13 when the World Trade Center was bombed, and it seemed to really have affected him. Is that the same type of condition that you're talking about?
Well, that's an interesting thing, that it would be something that's less immediate, but also depending, that's huge, a huge event that a lot of people know about.
Go ahead,
Tishal.
Again, these events that garner large amounts of attention in the media that don't have clear-cut details also shake, again, the assumptions of their basic assumptions about the world as a safe place. If it happened at the World Trade Center, will it happen to me at school? Will it happen to my parents in their work setting during the course of my school day? So, yes, these events that receive larger amounts of media attention definitely contribute to children's concerns about sense of safety. Remember, grief goes beyond tears. It's oftentimes this major event is the major loss, but it's all these secondary losses that accompany it, like loss of a sense of safety, loss of a sense of trust. These are the things that linger long after 9/11, long after a homicide or a suicide. It's these secondary losses that need to also be supported.
Well, and I think about kids who are kind of on the periphery, maybe that they're not best friends with the person who died. Maybe they're not an immediate relative, but that person played an important part of their understanding of their community, or that just what happened to that person is something that they had never even imagined happened to people before. Heather, could you comment on that?
What that's about, really, you're right. That does affect people. And thinking about what you just said and thinking about the World Trade Center, for example, what we're understanding about our community and people in the world today now is that people are affected by trauma. And that all is part of traumatic experiences. Tishal spoke earlier about teens re-experiencing some of what's going on. Those are symptoms of trauma. And so beyond the grief, sometimes this creates a longer term set of problems, psychological problems and emotional issues for them, because they do experience it as trauma, much in the same way that someone who's been through a traumatic event will experience it. And they may have to deal with that trauma later on as well.
Let's talk to Michael in Overland Park. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I was calling when I was 18. My mother was murdered, and I didn't see it happen, but I was the one that found her. I had already graduated high school, and I was living. I was not staying with parents anymore. My parents split up when I was very little, so I was on my own. So it wasn't like I was still going, you know, in class every day at high school and had to deal with, you know, the stress and pressure of being a part of that, you know, younger peer group. But in some ways, I think it was almost harder because I was getting ready to go to school. And when I did go to college, I ended up having to drop out, because the things that I'd seen were so visceral and so extreme that I couldn't concentrate on anything else but that for a long time. And sometimes I think that just the word grief and what people understand and think of grief is so much smaller than what it really is. There's when something like that happens, there's just so many more facets and things involved than just like, you know, outbursts of crying and the pain itself. I mean, it, everything. I mean, every relationship I had, you know, my ability to do simple tasks was, I couldn't do anything anymore.
And like grief is too small a word for it.
Right. It is too small of a word for it. And, you know, I have PTSD, which I think when people find out that I have that, their first reaction is, you know, they wonder if I served in the military. And I'm 26 now, and that's still something I deal with. And it's still, you know, I have hard times keeping jobs because, you know, I have flashbacks and a lot of times I have to leave work, and it's been a problem for, you know, years now.
Michael, and, I'm so sorry for what you've had to experience.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I just, I mean, I heard you guys on the radio this morning, and the funny thing was just, not funny, but last night I was having such a huge problem with it, and I thought that, you know, there's no outlet for me to, like, talk to people who you know, you can never expect people to fully understand what you've gone through, which is one thing that makes it so hard, is because you always feel like you're a little bit, that your story is a little bit different than everyone else's, and so it's really hard to relate. But when I hear you guys talking about it, it makes me feel like, you know, people do understand. So,
oh, thank you, Michael. Tichelle, what are you hearing in Michael's comments?
Oh, I'm hearing several things, and I'm also sorry for your loss and the ongoing struggles that you're having in the absence of support. Many people are able to cope with loss experiences, but what I hear him describing is the need for additional support to cope with what he's experiencing as continued trauma surrounding finding his mother at the time of death and loss. And then I also think you're right on. Grief, I don't know if grief is necessarily too small of a word as it is people's definitions of grief might be too small. Grief really encompasses that anger that you're feeling and these worries that you're feeling. This grief encompasses, again, much more than tears. It really is. So in any case, thank you again for sharing your experience.
And Michael, good luck in getting the help you need with that. Central Standard has to take one more short break. We'll return to this conversation about teens and grieving in just a few. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's guests are Heather Fitzcharles Keller and Tichelle Bordere. We are talking about teens and grieving. If you want to contribute something to this conversation or ask our guests a question, you can call 816-235-2888. Heather, thanks again for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, too, Tichelle.
Yes, you're very welcome.
We were just talking about that people's definition of grief doesn't necessarily have room in it for the extent of what anyone might feel, but particularly a teenager who's experienced a traumatic death. And Tichelle, is there anything more you wanted to say about that?
Yes. Again, teens may experience a variety of feelings surrounding loss. What I would love to do is for us to highlight some things that are important in supporting teens, because
yeah,
we know that they grieve. And if we could do some of that, does that work?
Yeah, please.
Awesome. So first of all, understanding that grief involves a myriad of feelings, from anger to, you know, in Ferguson right now, what we're seeing, and I think this might be useful for people listening in to that, some of the anger that we're seeing is really grief related, just due to historical feelings about being re-victimized in the legal system. Without getting into verdict things, just at the basic line, just considering grief as we look at that and not just looking at it as anger or misbehavior. Our teens need to be reassured that when these things happen, that it's not their fault. They're egocentric and they tend to think a lot of things are connected to them. It's not their fault. They need information about the experience, including what's happening in Ferguson. So to keep things as peaceful as possible, part of it is sometimes saying we don't know. Instead, we're trained to feel like we need to give answers. but perhaps saying we don't know why this happened. And sometimes that's the best that we can do, knowing that they're going to grieve in their own timetable. And this is very important. Our youth, when your world is shaken, when you've had a loss that feels unjust or has been sudden, our youth really need to see more examples of justice prevailing. You know, in the media, we constantly see no motive, no suspect, or, you know, they highlight the negative things. But our youth need to see more examples of alliances between police officers, for example, and community members, where police aren't just around to surveillance, and but are present in the community, have a different type of presence in the community where they are connecting. Yes.
You're talking a little bit about crime reporting, and I feel like, are you saying also that maybe there needs to be an equal amount of emphasis on how things play out beyond the event itself?
Yes. Absolutely. I think we tend to focus a lot on, we discount our youth. We view them as desensitized. We will call it everything but grief. When they look like they aren't showing behaviors that we didn't recognize in the first place, then we say they're desensitized. Then they go to school and they experience suffocated grief, where they are penalized for behaviors that teachers don't understand or really just expressions of grief. So what I am proposing is, A, that we call it what it is, that we call their experiences grief, their reactions to loss, but also that more alliances are built. Because right now, the focus is all on divisiveness. And I think I would love to see the media take control of this. And like you're doing right now, I appreciate you all even covering this topic right now, is to find ways that you can see that these adults that they should be able to count on as trustworthy, police officers, teachers, the youth, what I found in my research and many other people find is that these youth don't feel like they can count on these sources that are supposed to be in places to protect them. So they need to see more examples of justice. The court system needs to show more examples of acknowledgement of loss. No matter what the verdict is, loss needs to be acknowledged. That is so empowering for bereaved communities, just to basically acknowledge a loss or multiple losses have happened.
That's so interesting that the legal process would have a psychological impact, that's a psychological process as well.
The legal system, you know, and they aren't there to be grief counselors. So I'm not expecting everybody to do everything. But here's the deal, especially in these highly publicized cases, the legal system does have an opportunity to restore a sense of justice, even despite the verdict. By at baseline, we know that people from babies to adults, like they cope better when their loss at minimum gets recognized. And so the court system does have the ability to acknowledge at baseline that a loss has happened or multiple losses that are significant.
You know, something that I think about with all of this is that in the case of parents and teachers, not people in the legal system, but people
sure.
with relationships with these teenagers, that they have often experienced a really serious kind of pain themselves, that they are not unaffected necessarily by what has happened. So if it's a parent who's lost a child or a teacher who's lost a student, it seems almost superhuman to think that they could handle these situations with perfect clarity. But of course, it is important that they model at least a healthy grieving process. How do they do that? I'll ask you that first, Tichelle.
Okay. Well, one thing, and so again, this goes back to something that Heather and I have been, is parents are coping with their own losses, and it can be very difficult to talk to your child when you are just really overwhelmed with loss experience for yourself. In fact, that we have a name for that. It's called disenfranchised grief. And that's the, you know, where your losses don't get recognized in society. One thing that is so important that I really want to bring home, if nothing else gets heard today, is that we need grief education opportunities in our schools and for parents. That does not minimize the pain of a loss. Only time will help with that, and perhaps additional support. But if parents, you know, you can be as well-meaning as possible. If you aren't equipped with basic skills about how to support children, that it's okay to ask, remind them that it's not their fault, and so on, then you're going to miss an opportunity to support a child, even in a small but a significant way.
Heather, do you want to chime in here?
I think that I do agree with Tichelle in what she's saying. I think that what we need to see happen is that when these things occur, schools need to, not just the school where the losses occurred, for example, with the suicides. But other schools need to start conversations. They need to have situations where the teens can sit down and express their concern and their grief, to talk about things like the suicides, to talk about Ferguson, to talk about these things so that they can share their opinions, because they want to talk about it, but they don't feel like they have the opportunity to do that.
Let's talk to Bob and Shawnee. Hi, Bob.
Howdy.
What can you share?
Interesting topic. My mom passed away when I was 14. It was 25 years ago, but I was a freshman in high school, and it really, I mean, what you're saying really, you know, I think back to when it happened, and it was my dad and my sister, and I, you know, they were grieving themselves also. So that's tough, you know, for a parent to support a child when they're grieving themselves also. But basically, I just wanted someone to talk to and really never had to, I mean, you know, being a 14-year-old, I, you know, was, you know, smarter than everybody else. So, of course, and I went to my dad had me go to a psychologist once, but she had me hold a teddy bear because I was, you know, a tough guy or whatever. But it was ridiculous, you know. So I think the big key is just being able to talk to someone. Don't make it a big deal. Try not to make it a big deal, but don't, you know, set them down. Okay, now we're going to talk about the death of your mother. You know, how do you feel? You know, kind of go ahead, you know, and make it, take a, try, you know, as much as you can, a lighter approach and just say, hey, you know, how you feeling or how you doing? You know, and now I run into people who, you know, just at a, out in the community, you know, just talk to someone, hey, you know, they just went through a loss, you know, and they're older. And another, I'm lucky, you know, almost fortunate I went through that when I was younger, because it really gave me another perspective. Life's short, and that was kind of a double-edged sword, because I went off on drugs and alcohol as a teenager. But now I see people, you know, my own age who may lose a spouse or you know, something like that, and it's easier for me, I think, to talk to them, because I'll ask them, and people are so scared to talk to people that have gone through something like that. You know, they think they're gonna, something's gonna happen, but that's basically, you know, my comment.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. I want to get some feedback on that, especially that the people around a teenager are often people who have never experienced loss before.
Their peers, it's not that common. They're not experiencing loss. It is unusual. So the people that they trust the most are people who don't have a lot of experience with that. And it may be very hard for them to talk about it, to draw out the teen, to say, how are you doing?
That is one of the things Bob said that really interests me, is that I do remember being a teenager, and when people would try to talk to me about a really intense subject that did deserve a lot of, like, heaviness and weightiness, that the way they did it was so severe and so big that I wouldn't have known how to answer such a big question, and plus it made me uncomfortable when adults got so serious. How do you get past that?
It's just
like,
okay. Just like Bob said, just ask them how they're doing. This is what the kids that I work with for grief counseling, they just want someone to ask them how they're doing. And they will give you as much information as they need to in that moment. You may have a really big conversation with them, or you may have very little, but you let them lead. You just ask them how they're doing and trust that they can tell you.
Yeah.
Tashelle, what do you think?
I was going to say, that's great, Heather. She's right on point again. One thing that I would add is that, a couple of things. One is our male youth tend to be approached less often than females, because, you know, we talk to our girls more, unfortunately, in this society. And so it might be even more important to make sure that we're reaching out to our males. They might be less likely to show the tears in front of us or things of that nature because of the way boys are socialized, unfortunately, in biased ways sometimes, that don't allow them the same opportunities to express their feelings. And then secondly, finding other ways maybe that are less threatening. I've talked to youth on a basketball court about these experiences. So sometimes when they're engaged in other tasks where the focus is not on the grief, but on another behavior, and then allowing that as your way in. And then one final thing is that it's really culture specific. In some communities that you know, they're coping with profound amounts of loss in urban areas where there are higher rates of loss. There are large numbers of people who are very familiar with loss and are more likely to talk to each other.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's conversation. Heather Fitzcharles Keller, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
And to Shel Bordere, your insights were so helpful with this difficult topic.
Thank you so much for covering this important topic.
Later today, when we post this show online at kcur.org, we'll provide access to both of our guests' information as well as to resources that might help people who need them. Tomorrow, we're going to tell you what time it is with a check-in on the wristwatch. Are trends in wearable technology making a comeback? Find out tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. But stick around for Up to Date, coming right up next. We'll be right back.